Dr. J Interviews is a collection of candid conversations with good Black professional men regarding life and career choices. I'm your host, Dr. J McCarthy. I'd like to welcome to my show, Dr. Lede. How you doing today, brother?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, I appreciate it, man. Appreciate it. Really excited to chat with you today, and pretty soon my listeners will understand why. So let's just go ahead and dive right in. What do you do for a living?
Yeah, man. So right now I'm finishing up my medical school training and business school training at Tulane University School of Medicine. And also I'm the co-founder of the 15 White Coats, which is an organization of 15 Black medical students that are trying to, you know, increase accessibility for people who look like us going into medicine.
I love it. And we're definitely going to touch on that. Typically, during these interviews, I wait a little bit later to explain how I found my guest, but I want to change it up today. So I was on social media and I ran across a story of a brother that went from hospital security to a doctor at the same hospital.
Yeah.
So, of course, I had to reach out to him. An incredibly inspiring story. So much that Dr. Lede has been featured on The Washington Post, Dr. Oz, WebMD, Teen Vogue, People, CNN, BT, Fox Soul, Nature, BBC, Good Morning America, The Clarkson Show, The Steve Harvey Show, NBC News, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not even all of them, right? Very, very thankful and humble that you took the time to spend some moments with me during this podcast. And we definitely are going to get into that story of yours. But let's just talk about your career for a little bit. So what's a typical day for you?
Yeah, man. So typical day, I'm up at like 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning, generally about 4:30. And I usually meditate every morning. So I'll spend anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes just alone, just listening to some music, maybe just, you know, praying or just quietly trying to center myself, to prepare for my day. I think that's the one thing that's probably the most serious part of my day. I try to do it every day. And so after that, I'll eat me a little breakfast, maybe go for a little exercise and then drive into the hospital. So I go back on Monday and, I'll spend anywhere from, let's say 6 a.m. to like maybe 5:30, 6 p.m. In the hospital between understanding what patients need to be seen, what patients will be seen that day, depending on where I am and what rotation I'm on, whether it's, you know, in the war, so I'm getting ready to go into internal medicine. And so right now I'm spending time with patients who have a wide range of illnesses, from coming in with like severe hypertension and the issues that come with having severe hypertension for prolonged periods of time, like heart issues and edema in their legs, not being able to breathe, which is called pulmonary edema, to patients who are stroke patients, to even dealing with people who have severe diabetes, you know? So it's a wide range of illnesses on this particular rotation. And then, you know, I try to come home and spend some time with my kids. I have two little girls.
Dope.
And my wife, who have, this year we make 15 years of marriage. Been together since high school.
Love it. Hashtag Black love.
Yeah, hashtag Black love. You know, after that, we pretty much, we try to settle down and I'll go and study. And that's if I'm on days. Like if it's a night, then, you know, I'll go in a little bit later, like maybe 5, 6 p.m. and get off the next morning. So it just all depends. Schedules change. This current rotation, I'm pretty sure the schedule will be all over the place. And then when you get a day off, you obviously try to enjoy it. It's not like the cookie cut schedule, which is kind of crazy because like oftentimes it's kind of difficult to describe my schedule because it's all over the place. And obviously in between all of that, I have to think about what the 15 White Coats needs, what I can do to try to help out, talk to my teammates, the other managers and you know, try to do what we can on that front too. So we're balancing a lot. Right now I'm trying to, you know, help my daughter get a clothing company off the ground. So it's a lot of stuff going on, but it's all fun. That's the best part about it.
I love it. So you're doing your residency right now?
No, I'm finishing up medical school. I go into residency in 2022. So this is my last, this is my last full year of medical school.
So for a young brother that wants to go into medicine, can you explain to them the schooling, like how much time it takes?
Yeah, so typically you finish high school, and let's say, for instance, you go straight to medical school. Straight to undergrad. So let's say, for instance, you go to Ohio State for undergrad, right? You're going to spend typically 4 years there. If you do it just right, you can apply to medical school as you're finishing undergrad. So most seamless way to do this would be while you're in undergrad, you're doing things like making really good grades, you know, getting in a few clubs that really speak to your interest in medicine and things like that, doing some research, because that typically bolsters people's applications for medical school. And then as you're finishing up the second half of your third year of undergrad, you can take a test called the MCAT. That's the Medical College Admissions Test. If you take that test and you do, you do well, you can apply to medical school. So there's this application process called the AMCAS, which is the American Medical College Admissions System. And basically your test score is put into that system along with the rest of your application. So that application will have literally every grade you've ever made in college and all of the extracurricular activities that you've had. You'll have 4 to 5 letters from people who want to write positive letters of recommendation for you. You'll choose what schools you want your application to go to. You'll have your test score within there. You'll have some biographical information in there. And then all of that will be compiled, checked through the system, and then it'll be sent to those medical schools. Those medical schools will then sift through those applications and select which people they want to extend what's called a secondary application to. So they've already gotten your primary application through the AMCAS system, right? And now they're asking for a secondary application. That secondary application will give them a little bit more nuanced information specifically about you. And then you take that information, you provide that to them, and then they'll take that information and decide on whether or not they want to give you an interview. In the past, prior to COVID, in this pandemic, you were able to go to the institutions to interview. Obviously, that's very, very, very unlikely right now, just due to traveling restrictions with COVID and things of that nature. And so essentially at this point, what it is that you do pretty much what we're doing right now. Like you're on a Zoom call with them and they'll take you through the institution. They have presentations and medical students who will come and sit down and talk to you and things of that nature. So after that, then there's a waiting process. You decide, like, so you may do, 10, 20, maybe even 30 interviews. And this is a costly process. That's the part that I think often gets missed, is that this is a costly process. And so at this point, what it is that you have to wait on them to accept you. So they can accept you, they can waitlist you, or they can just outright reject you. And so once you're accepted, right, then you're preparing to start medical school. So you'll start medical school. Some schools start in late July, some schools start in early August. It all depends on what school you end up going to. And so then you go through 4 years of medical school. The way medical school is structured is that the first 2 years of medical school are strictly coursework. So you're in the classroom, and you're learning all about the different systems of the body, anatomy, physiology, disease process, and all these different things, right? And then you take a big test at the end of those 2 years, which is called the USMLE Step 1. After you take that first board exam, that's your very first medical board exam, then you start on the wards. So that's where I'm at right now. And when you're on the wards is when you're in the hospital helping to understand how do I take care of patients. It's one thing to understand the knowledge, right? It's a whole nother thing to understand how to apply that knowledge to a patient, a complex patient. Because generally when you're in the classroom, the patients may be complex, but there's only one right answer when you take a test. Or there's one most right answer. It's probably the best way to put it. But in the real world, it doesn't work like that. In the real world, there could be multiple right answers. And it just all depends on the patient. Sometimes it depends on what their insurance is, depends on what's available, depends on a lot of different factors. Sometimes it even depends on the physician preference. So you finish your third year of medical school, which is essentially rotating through surgery, pediatrics, OB-GYN, which is obstetrics and gynecology, neurology, psychiatry, internal medicine, in family medicine. And you may also do some stuff in radiology as well as emergency medicine. And that's pretty much giving you an opportunity to have a flavor of all the different parts of medicine. And then after all of that, then you take another board exam, which is step two. And so after you take step two, then you start to decide, like, what do I want to do as a specialty in medicine? So, you know, generally when you go to the doctor, right, you'll have an orthopedic surgeon, you'll have a general surgeon, you'll have a pediatrician, you'll have an ear, nose, and throat doc. You know, you have all these different types of doctors, right? So that's because they went to different what's called residencies. And those residencies have differing lengths of time. So, for instance, I'm interested in going into what's called a triple board residency, which is 5 years. So by this point, I've spent 4 years in undergrad, 4 years in medical school, and then 5 years in residency. Mine's is a little bit different because I also went and got a PhD. So it's a little bit, yeah, my story's a little bit different. And by a little bit, I mean actually a lot, but the point is that in general, let's say for instance, a neurosurgeon, neurosurgeon can spend 10 years in residency, 9 to 10 years in residency, plus 4 years of medical school, plus 4 years of undergrad. We're talking about 18 years before they become a full-fledged independent operating physician. Yeah. As opposed to me, right? I went to 4 years of undergrad, 4.5 years for a PhD. So we're at 8.5, plus another 4 for medical school. That's 12.5, plus 5. So that's 17.5 years before I'm an independently operating physician. And I say that because it helps to put into perspective when you're sitting down talking to a physician, how much knowledge they have, like how much education, how much weight there is behind.
Yeah.
When you put it in context, it kind of helps to understand it.
When you go through medical school, how do you, funding, because you can't really work another job, can you?
No, you can't. So generally, you take out loans. So we talking about $300,000 in loans, if that makes sense.
When you start your residency, do you get paid?
Yeah, you get paid in residency.
What's the difference in what you get paid in a residency versus once you become a doctor?
Oh, you mean in terms of pay between residency and when you're in attending?
Yes.
So in residency, in your first year, I think right now it's like $55,000, I think, or something like that. It all depends on where you're at in the country. And then it depends on what specialty you go into. Right? Like, all right, let's say, for instance, you finish residency at $85,000. You finish in your last year residency, you're at $85,000, $90,000 a year. Maybe. In your first job, you may make, depending on what field you go into, $200,000, $220,000, $300,000. So that's a pretty big jump.
Yeah.
How much money you make in residency as opposed to, you know, what some people say, like my first big doctor check. I'll never forget when one of my good friends, he's a radiologist. he got his first big doctor check. And that was a lot of money for 1 month.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I was like, wow, bro, that's a lot of money.
So before I get into your story, a couple of notes that I saw. So you're an Army vet? Navy vet. I'm sorry. My brother-in-law is Navy, so I know better. A Sigma representing Divine Nine.
Blue Phi.
I hear you.
You know it.
I see you were on a list of 1,000 aspiring black scientists in America.
Yeah, that was awesome. That's a big one there.
Oh, that's phenomenal, brother. And then before we get to your story, can you take some time and explain the White Coats, the 15 White Coats?
Yeah, man. So the 15 White Coats was founded after this photo that we took went viral. So that photo right above my head right now is a photo of 15 black medical students who are in medical school at Tulane right now. Some of them are in my class, some of them are not. And essentially, what happened is the summer of 2019, July of 2019, I went to this plantation, the Whitney plantation, with one of my best friends who was also getting his PhD in the same lab as me. He came down to visit and I brought my daughter along and, you know, she was just doing what kids do. I don't think she could really understand the weight of going there to visit and what that really meant. Just because at the time she was like 8 years old, you know, and even now thinking back, I'm like, man, she was eight. When you were eight, you were struggling to understand, you know, where up was and where down was. And so, you know, I had her come with us. And as we were driving back, she said something to me that I will never forget. She was like, Dad, I finally understand why being a black doctor in America is a big deal. And so you have an 8 year old telling you something like this, you trying to like frame it, you know, you trying to understand like, what is she talking about? And so when she said this to me, she essentially went on to tell me that, you know, the reason why I said that is because we just left a plantation. And there was a time when like people who look like us couldn't be anything other than enslaved, you know? And so the fact that I'm riding in the car with two black doctors is a big deal. And so, of course, I went back. I talked to some of my close friends, the Sydney Labatts. I ran it by a couple people, Carrie Crook, Jasmine Taylor. There's a couple people I ran it by, Gabrielle Usansa. And they were supported, you know, and I was like, yo, I think we could do something that'll like change the world. Of course, sometimes when you say this stuff, you like half-heartedly mean it. And part of the reason why you half-heartedly mean it is because like it only happens like once in a lifetime. You know, that something like that happens. And then I remember sending an email to everyone and saying, like, look, we're going to take this photo and we're going to show the whole world how far we've come. And like 15 people signed up, 14 showed up. And we took that photo of me. And then some of us posted it to social media and it went haywire. Literally went haywire. And I'll never forget, our first interview was with People Magazine. People Magazine called us, was talking to us, and then it just kind of like one thing after another, man. People Magazine happened, and then CNN happened, and we were on with, it wasn't Poppy Harlow, it was someone else. I forgot her name. She gave us a shot on CNN, and we started getting some donations from that, and then Kelly Clarkson called us and flew us out to LA, and I think we might have been like one of the last interviews in person, which was really cool because we actually got to sit down with the dad from American Pie.
Okay.
And that was really cool. And then, you know, I think from that we realized like, okay, we could do something amazing. Like we could take that photo and put it in classrooms all over the world and just show people just how far we've come and illustrate to them what the meaning of resilience is. So we trademarked the shirt that I'm wearing, Resilience is in our DNA. And, you know, there's a couple more things that we were able to do, and we've been able to do some really magical things in terms of providing scholarships for people, doing inspiring events here in New Orleans. And we're going to do a lot more in 2021, man. Yeah, it's amazing what we've been able to do thus far. We have a website, the15whitecoast.org, and of course we're on every platform. The 15 White Coast is on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, you name it. So it's really cool to see the work that we're doing now and how much people are supporting it. That's the crazy part.
That's incredibly dope. And I got to get one of those shirts.
Nah, we got you, man. Just send me the address and we'll take care of you.
I got you, man. I appreciate that. That's my slogan, man. Resilience, man.
Nah, we got you. We got you covered. Just send us your address and we'll take care of you.
That's so fire, man. You know, I'm really big on images. Mm-hmm. And I was having a conversation with somebody here, you know, like Black History Month, for example, Martin Luther King. That's all you're going to get, you know? Mm-hmm. And I grew up from Ohio, as you can see.
Mm-hmm.
We walked down the halls, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Man, the list goes on and on. And we saw these images, so we thought highly of ourselves, you know. But that image of those doctors, for people listening, please go check that out. It is a beautiful thing to see.
I mean, it's definitely one of those things that people have and continually tell us, like, man, that photo is...
That's fire, man.
I'm in awe of what y'all did. Still, you know, it still brings chills to some people. So we're proud of it, man. And I guess the best part is that we're proud that we can say that we own it.
Yes.
And that an institution doesn't own it, you know. That's really meaningful.
Fire, brother. Fire. I love it, man. So let's jump in this story, man. Tell me how you came from a security guard. You went from Otis to Doogie Howser.
Yeah, man. You know, I grew up in this little small town called Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Gotcha.
Lake Charles, Louisiana is a little small town in southwest Louisiana. And shout out to my city, man, because it just got hit with this really bad hurricane. Hurricane Laura came through and ravaged my home. Yeah, but I mean, we've been able to do some amazing work to try to help them out. But nevertheless, so... You know, things were rough. My mom raised us as a single parent. And so as I was finishing high school, I had to figure out what I was going to do with my life. You know, I really didn't have the means nor even knew how to apply to college. So essentially what ended up happening was I was in this like Navy program that was similar to NROTC when I was in high school. And this program sort of exposed me to the Navy. And so as I was graduating high school, I sat down and talked to my mom and was like, Mom, you know, could you take me to the recruiting office? I'm thinking about maybe going to the Navy. I just want to see how well I do on this ASVAB exam. So I took the ASVAB and did really well. And so they gave me a job in intelligence. So when I got through boot camp, I got selected for this thing called the United States Navy Ceremonial Guard. Ceremonial Guard is in Washington, D.C. And it's basically the people that you generally see on TV who just standing still for hours on end. It's like all these different important, you know, events and stuff are going on. So I did that for 2 years. And as I was finishing it up, then I finally got to go to cryptology school down in Pensacola, Florida. And then after I finished cryptology school in Pensacola, Florida, then I went over to Jacksonville, Florida, and was aboard the USS John L. Hall, which is a small boy frigate ship out of Mayport, Florida. Small little area. It's like the naval base of Jacksonville, Florida. And so, you know, by this point, I was married. I actually got married while I was in Washington, D.C. I think I was like 19 or something like that. And so by this point, we were deploying like regularly. And so finally, one day my wife was like, you know, when it was time for me to re-up, she was like, nah. She's like, nah, bro. She's like, it's either me or the Navy. She's like, but it ain't going to be both of us. So I ain't on board with this because you're deploying too often and I want to build a family and this is just crazy, you know, and this and that. And so, you know, obviously what I ended up doing was, you know, sitting down after we argued a few times and like, yo, so what you want me to do? I'm like, yo, I got to have a job. I got to do something. And she was like, I think you're smart enough to go to college. I was like, yo, you crazy. I was like, you out of your mind. Because at that time, like, I didn't really know nobody who had gone to college. You know what I'm saying? So, like, for me, it wasn't one of those things where, you know, I understood what was going on. So my wife helped me to apply to college, and I got into college. I got off active duty, and I got into the reserves because I still needed to make some money. The reserves don't pay you nearly as much as active duty, but they pay you something. We moved from Jacksonville to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I started school at Southern University, A&M College, which is a historically black college in Louisiana. And while I was there, we bought our first home and obviously got to make ends meet. So I had to work and go to college at the same time. The only job I applied for was to be a security guard at the hospital. That was the only one. And I wasn't doing it because it was at a hospital. I was doing it because it was the only job that I found at the time. And I was like, yo, like, yeah, I think I could do this. And when I interviewed, they was like, yeah, we willing to work with your school schedule. So I was like, bet. So I got to college, thought I was going to be a social worker. I came into college with the idea that I was going to be a social worker. Sat in on a chemistry class in my first semester. And I was just sitting there like rambling off the answers to all these different questions. And my professor pulled me to the side and was like, yo, you ever thought about science? And I was like, nah, first of all, I don't even know anybody who look like me who becomes a scientist. So, you know, why are you asking me that? And she was like, because you're really good at this. And I'm going to put you in touch with a scientist. So she put me in touch with the scientist and he really cultivated my interest in chemistry and biology. So I ended up majoring in chemistry and biology while I was at Southern University.
Oh, wow.
And then at the same time, I was still working at the hospital as a security guard. And then on the weekends, I was doing the Navy Reserves in Pensacola, Florida, which is like a 5.5-hour, 6-hour drive away. So my normal schedule when I was an undergrad was wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, maybe get a run in or something like that, and then go to school. Sometimes I had to drop my daughter off to daycare, go to school, stay in school from like 8 to 3, 3:15, and then book it straight to the hospital from the school and then work there from 4 to midnight. Get off at midnight, come home, and I was remodeling my house throughout my second and third year of undergrad. So I would work on my house at like when I got off from the hospital, sleep for a little bit, wake up the next morning and do it every day. And then at the same time, when I started shadowing that doctor that everybody now knows about, right? Sometimes what I would do is I'd go to school in the morning, work in the evening till midnight, stay over till the next morning, and then work with him the next day. When I had to go to school, I could go in the OR with him in the operating room with him. So it was a grind, man. And then on weekends that I had to do reserves, what I would do is I'd go to school in the morning, work till midnight, and then just drive straight from the hospital to Pensacola, Florida, which was a 6-hour drive, and get there because work started for the Navy at 7 a.m. Work all day on Saturday, get off work, go home, study a little bit, sleep. Not go home, but go to the hotel because they provide you a hotel. And then work the next day on Sunday and then drive back to Louisiana so that I could go to school on Monday morning. So it was the grind, man, but I love it because I love that I went through that. And I also love that I was strong enough to do it because now I'm like, it's hard to find something that's going to shake me.
Bruh, say that again for the people in the back.
You know, you're going to have a hard time finding something that's going to rattle me.
Fire, brother. So if people don't know this story, tell them about the doctor that actually let you shadow him.
Yeah, man. So, you know, when I was in undergrad and I was doing science, I was also like enamored by being in the hospital, man. I didn't even go into the hospital with the intentions of seeing this, bro. But basically, I was a security guard, so I had access to everything. You know, all the rooms and all the different back ways, the OR, everything. Like, you could walk around any and everywhere. You know, the ER, everything. And you see everything. Because you need security everywhere in the hospital. But there was two different things that were happening simultaneously. One is that I was constantly seeing white coats. And there's one particular place where I was seeing white coats, bro, and it was just like, it was a different feeling. So there was this ramp in the front of the hospital. And in front of that ramp was a doctor's parking lot. So the doctors were parking this parking lot, right? And then they could walk up these steps and then walk across the ramp and walk into the front of the hospital. And there was a security guard sitting right there outside to sort of monitor the whole area. That was also where patients were discharged. So, you know, these trucks and, you know, cars and stuff could come up, get patients who were going home, but also doctors could come in straight into the hospital from there. So I would be sitting out there in the evening time, 7-8 o'clock at night, with these index cards, because I did a lot of my studying while I was at work. I just didn't have much of a choice, you know? And basically what was happening was I was seeing these doctors like come in, you know, through this parking lot, and I would always try to like get their attention, you know, just try to talk to them or whatever. But first of all, I'm in a security uniform. You know, I'm looking like top flight security of the world. You know, and I'm literally sitting there with like, you know, a little index card sitting here studying. And I'm like, yo, like, can I shadow you? Can I shadow you? Like, yo, can you just tell me what being a doctor is like? Yo. And they all like, bruh, missing me with all that. Like, come on, man, you're a security guard. You ain't gonna be no doctor. You know, so, but, you know, when you're a security guard, you don't just stay at one post, you rotate. So you could get relief from one post and you'll move to somewhere else. Well, it just so happened that on that night, I was in the ER and I was standing outside of the ER, and there was this doctor who was a surgeon who was coming through the ER, which is atypical. Usually they come up at that ramp where I was telling you about, and come in through that way to get to the operating room. But I don't know if Dr. Greifenstein knew where he was going. So he parked over there and then walked into the ER, and he was like, yo, how do I get to the operating room? So basically what happened was he needed somebody to escort him through the ER, because it's kind of like the back way to get to the operating room. So I told him, I was like, yo, don't worry about it. I'll escort him. And so I started escorting him. We got all the way through the ER and we was on like this little back hallway. And I looked down at his coat and I was like, yo, you really a surgeon? He was like, yeah, I'm a surgeon. Oh, bet. I was like, you think I can shadow you? And he looked at me and he was like, yeah, why not? He's like, I don't see why not. And I'll never forget it, bro, because I was like, yo, well, let me get your phone number then, since you're talking about I could shadow you. Because I doubted what he was talking about when he told me. I was like, yo, like, come on, man. Like, if you're serious, then you're going to give me your phone number. So, nevertheless, he gave me his phone number. And I was texting the hell out of him, bro. Like, I was like, yo, like, I don't want you to forget who I am. You know, yeah, man, we got to keep this. Like, I need for you to be serious about what you're saying. You know, and buddy was like, nah, man, I'm serious. Like, I'll let you shadow me. So, like, maybe a day or two later, bro, he literally got the paperwork and stuff together. We got it signed and everything. And he let me come into the OR with him. And who was the first person I saw in the OR, bro? A black breast oncology surgeon, bro.
Wow.
Seriously, bro. And I was like, bro, this can't be real, dog. Like, I can't believe this. Like, this crazy. And so after the surgery, Dr. Bostic, who was the black surgeon, and that was his boss, we were sitting in the doctor's lounge, me, Patrick, and Dr. Bostic. And sure as I tell you, man, Dr. Bostic was running the game to me. He was like, yo, you could become a doctor, blah, 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 blah. I'm so happy you're here, blah, 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 blah. I literally still have the image, bro, of the day that I was, that I shadowed with him, bro. I took a photo Cause he let, cause you know, they let you put on scrubs and everything, bro. And I took a photo in the bathroom where no one knew. Like, I was too ashamed. I was so excited, but I was too ashamed to tell him, like, yo, you mind me just like taking a picture with y'all? So I was in the bathroom, bro, and I just took a photo of myself, with my surgeon hat on and everything. And I kept it, bro, because I wanted to remind myself, like, yo, like, now you really can do this. So yeah, man. So that was undergrad. As I was finishing undergrad, I don't think at the time I was prepared to go directly to medical school. So I got an opportunity to start a PhD program at NYU School of Medicine. So I looked at my wife and was like, yo, we moving to New York. Being the supportive wife that she is, she was like, all right, sounds good. Let's make it happen. You know, because at this point, she kind of had gotten what she wanted, right? She had, you know, signed up for me to, you know, get out of the military and figure out something else to do with my life. And at this point, I was actually doing it and taking life by the reins, trying to figure out what I was, you know, what I was capable of doing. And so we went off to NYU and I, you know, was working on my PhD. And a lot of that work was recognized by some, you know, big institutions like the National Institutes of Health, the Ford Foundation, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which is like a huge, huge, huge deal. And then I finished my PhD and started medical school at Tulane University School of Medicine on a full ride.
Wow.
So up until this point, I literally have gotten two bachelor's degrees, a master's, a PhD, and I'll have an MD. And I didn't pay for any of that. The only thing I paid for was the MBA that I'm getting.
What are your bachelor's in?
Chemistry and biology.
I'm going to tell you what's so powerful about your story. Everything, of course. But I think the brothers, we just got this natural hustle to us. So yeah. I love how you just kept being persistent. But I think what we miss sometimes, and what you did, you were prepared. Yeah. You know, and I always tell my sons, and I mentioned this before, success is where that preparation meets that opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you were prepared. You had the gift of gab. You were studying. So as soon as someone gave you the opportunity, you was ready to jump on it. And mm-hmm. I think that's a powerful story for young brothers. That is an awesome thing, man.
Yeah, man. It's definitely, you know, Nipsey Hussle said opportunity meets preparation. It's nice. You know, and so it's definitely, that's really what it is. You know, I always tell people, like, listen, when I'm sitting down talking to you about some plans, this is for like 5 years down the road. What we doing right now was planned for like 2-3 years ago, 3-4-5 years ago. So we ain't talking about right now. Like right now it's taken care of. We talking about down the road. And you know, that preparation positions you for something very different.
Yes.
You know, some people are, I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't be caught off guard by things, but it just means that, you know, you understand in which direction things are going and you're looking forward to which way things are going. You're paying attention to the waves, you're paying attention to the way things are moving. And I've learned that that's important. That's an important thing to do.
Awesome. Awesome, brother. So now we're kind of winding down to the end of the interview. I got three questions that I ask everybody, mm-hmm. but I'm going to add a fourth one on there. What's your favorite MD show or movie?
I would say my favorite show is probably House.
Nice.
Yeah. But not because of the knowledge or the information, but just because I think the erratic, like, movement and culture that's illustrated in that movie is, it's not that far-fetched.
I like it. I like that show, man.
Yeah.
So, first question. We all know that everything you went through growing up, necessary for us to go through certain stuff, navigating through life. If you can go back in time to your younger self, what advice would you give?
Yeah, you know, people ask me this all the time, and it's going to sound crazy, but I don't know, man. And the reason why I say I don't know is because, like, I'm not living the life I dreamed as a kid. Like, the things I dreamed about as a kid is, like, not having to dig in a dumpster for dinner.
Bro.
Like, that's what it was. I was recently at this church event, and everybody was talking about, like, you know, the question was, what did you dream of being when you grow up as a kid? And my response was, when it got to me, I was like, I just dreamed of not being broke. And everybody in the room was like, oh, I want to be a firefighter. I want to be a journalist. I want to be this. And I was like, you know what I was thinking about as a kid? Like, dang, man, when is my mom going to have enough money?
That's real, man.
Like, so, you know, as a kid, I don't know what kind of advice I would have needed as a kid. I think I got through it the best way I possibly could. I think a lot of the things that I would have told myself right now to then would have came from a place of privilege. Like, oh, you need to make sure that you leverage your relationships and stuff like that. And you, like, as a kid, you like, bro, what you talking about? Like, man, we eating oodles and noodles. My mama counting pennies to put the rent money together. What are you talking about? Resources. Yeah. You better come give me these resources because I don't know what you're talking about. And my mama ain't even got time, you know, and of course my mama was my staple, you know, she was the center, you know, so I think a lot of the things I would have told my younger self now, man, it would be coming from a place of privilege, right? It legitimately would. Which is why I stay so close to the hood, because I don't ever want to forget where I came from.
Right.
And so that's important to me. You know, maybe for some other people, they want to forget where they came from. I don't never want to forget where I came from, because I know that there's some kids who are going through what I went through as a kid right now, you know, and it's my job to try to help them, not come to them as a savior or something like that, but to understand that, like, just like I went through it, things ain't changed that much. Kids are going through the exact same thing right now. And then obviously things are more expensive now, so it might even be harder, you know? Yeah. So that's what's real. I understand that people have this 2020 hindsight thing going on. And I ain't knocking people who have the insight to tell their younger self something. But I would have told my younger self, like, look, do what you did. Because it obviously worked.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's deep you say that, brother, because me and my partner, we talk about this all the time. We were from the inner city, similar environment, single family homes. And I don't know if I would change anything. You know, it gave me my drive. It showed me what the father not being there, the kind of father I wanted to be, you know? Yeah. So I feel you on that 100%, man.
Yeah, man. I think the father I am now, I tweeted this just a few days ago. The father I am now is compensation for the fathering I didn't get as a child.
Yes.
I'm trying to catch up on something that I didn't have.
Exactly.
I'm trying to provide something. It's an imagination thing too, because, like, when you didn't experience it, you're just imagining what it was supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, when I'm hugging my kids and talking to them and trying to instill in them certain principles and things like that, that's just me imagining what I think it was supposed to be like. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know for sure that's what it was supposed to be like because I ain't experienced it. You know, just like husbandry, right? Like, I'm a dedicated husband. Like, I love spending time with my wife. I love spending time learning about her and all these different things. And I'm just imagining what healthy relationships look like. You feel me? Because, like, my mom ain't have any healthy relationships when I was growing up. Not one. I ain't seen one healthy relationship when I was growing up. One healthy, loving relationship, whether it was platonic or intimate or whatever. Like, I didn't see that. You know, I'm learning as time goes on, like, what an intimate relationship looks like, what it's supposed to be like, what somebody caring for you looks like, what somebody loving on you looks like, accepting love. Like, you know, people don't realize, like, when you haven't experienced some of these things happening for you, right? It's hard for you to accept it. Like, it's hard for you to even trust that what somebody's giving you is authentic. And so, you know, it's just, it's a challenge, man, but it's a challenge that I was dealt. It's the one I was given. So I can't really blame God on why I'm in the situation I'm in terms of what I experienced as a kid, but I also don't trade it because it's what makes my story so beautiful. you know.
I love it, brother.
Yeah, I was talking to my homie, man, and we were watching the, it was a special in the Fab Five. And I don't know if you remember back in the day, most of those brothers, they couldn't stand Grant Hill. You know, Grant Hill came from a good family. He had his mother and father and stuff. And me and my homie were like, we were kind of the same way. And it, we didn't understand what that envy was. We just felt like you had an advantage we didn't have, you know. And then I fast forward to now, I'm coaching kids. I'm living in the suburbs now. But I like to take my kids back to the inner city to play. And I could see the kids looking at me the same way, you know. And I make sure I go talk to them one-on-one outside of the game, give them hugs, you know, encourage them. And so I really appreciate brothers like you that are rooted in going back and extending a hand and making sure these young brothers know, like, you could do this too, man. You know, that's really where this podcast came from. You know, when we were growing up, we didn't know many paths, you know. And when I talk to brothers like you, you could be like, hey, he did this, man. He like, I had a partner, and I'm going to put him on blast because I wanted to bring him on the podcast, but he don't want to come on. But I know for, was it two quarters? We were in quarters back at Old State. He didn't even have a dorm. And he was driving back and forth about an hour from our hometown, you know what I'm saying, just making it happen because he was just like, I got to be the first one in my family to get this degree, you know. So when I hear these stories, I hear people talking about resilience, I connect with it, man. Like you said, it's in our DNA. Man, I love it.
Yeah, man. Nah, that's what it is, man.
That's fire, man. All right, the second question I got for you, man. I'm a big proponent of strengthening one's mind, body, and spirit. So can you tell me something you do to strengthen one or all three of those areas?
Yeah, man, I meditate a lot, bro. You know, I just meditate a lot, man, just spending time, like, listening to, you know, for me personally, I listen to gospel music. I love music, man. Like, I really love music. This morning, I was listening to Gutter Rainbows, which is by Talib Kweli. And before that, I was listening to Rhapsody, which is this artist out of North Carolina. So I spend a lot of time just getting lost, you know, in artistry, creativity, music. So that helps me to be balanced. But lately, I've also been spending some time just like sharing my vulnerabilities with my wife. And that helps a lot too. You know, when you find your loved ones, and you could just tell them, like, you know, what's hurting, what feels good, you know, what you got going on, and they listen, it's priceless, man. Yeah. And so for me, I find a lot of solace in that, you know, and a lot of comfort in just sitting down and just sharing my life's experiences with my wife. It just like, it provides this jolt in my heart because it's amazing. It's amazing to get this opportunity. A lot of things that I'm doing now, I wish I would have been able to do as a child. Mm-hmm. Like share how I felt, share what was making me feel good, what was making me feel terrible. What was I concerned about? What my worries were, what my fears were, what my strengths were, what my weaknesses were. But now that I have somebody who's like attentively listening, it feels amazing. And they're not listening to provide an answer. They literally just there to like learn about you as a person. You rarely find someone who's interested in just learning about you as a person. You feel me? So,
yes.
Yeah, man, I'm experiencing that part of life now, and it's doing wonders for my mental health, for my physical health, for my emotional health, and even for my intimate health, man. Like people, you know, especially Black men, you know, every time we have conversations about intimacy, it's always like, it's a joke or something like that. But like, mm-hmm. That's an important part of who we are as human beings, you know? And so it's important for us to deal with all those different aspects of who we are as people.
That's dope, man. You know, and one thing I'm unapologetic about is Black love, you know, and I feel like the media, they don't show it. We act like we're embarrassed about it. I love seeing Black families, brother. I big them up right to my CMA. It's a beautiful thing to see and to have someone that can connect with you on a spiritual level. Like me and my wife, we could look at each other and just, we've been together like 22 years. 2021. Well, I guess it's 22 this year. And like, we just know each other, man. And you can't put a price on that.
Nah.
You can't put a price on that connection you have.
Yeah. Nah, you know exactly what I'm talking about, bro. It's just like, you know, it's crazy because like, a part of the reason why I feel so good is because when you really needed it, you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you trying to recoup it. And every time you get that little bitty inkling of that feeling that you would imagine it would have felt like as a kid, it's like God just dropped a gem in your heart. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like God just dropped a diamond in the pool. You know what I'm saying? Like, he dropped another penny in the wishing well. You know, every moment I get a breakthrough to share something with my wife that, you know, I've been married to my wife for almost 15 years, bro. And there are like things that I'm still like remembering I need to share with her. And like those moments when she like, I never knew that about you. And
yeah,
you can see the like light up in her eyes. I'm like, dang, bro, like I have a person that I can share this with, you know, and like I can share this vulnerability, this whatever. And it's not going to be to my detriment. You know what I'm saying? Because there are so many things that like, at least for me, when I was growing up, there were definitely things that I was afraid to share about how I was feeling, you know, if I was sad or if I was worried or whatever, you know, that was looked at as like, you know, for the worst term, like you a punk or yeah, you whack or you this or you that. And it's like, nah, I'm human.
Exactly.
You know, I'm exactly human and I'm trying to be healthy. And that's why I'm sharing this with you. But you sitting here trying to kill me for doing what humans do. Mm-hmm. You know, so I definitely feel you, man. It's a special thing to have. I always say, like, people can say what they want about, you know, the concept of marriage, bro, but I've been married long enough to experience marital bliss. And it's something I don't think you can put a price tag on.
You really can't. And I'm going to tell you another reason why I'm glad you said that. We both have daughters. And, you know, there's this narrative out there that black women aren't desired, you know, and you read stuff and you hear these stories. To hear a brother talk about his love for a black woman has so much power, you know. Yeah. So I love that you're celebrating your wife. You know, I brought one of my brothers on and he didn't expect me to say this, but I told people on the air, this is the type of dude that speaks highly about his wife, even when she's not around, you know, so it speaks to his character. And I want people to know that there are black men like that exists.
I don't know if you saw it on Instagram, but my wife and I started this series. It's like little small episodes of us just sitting down talking. But basically, I've been doing my wife's hair for over a decade.
Nice.
Yeah, I've been doing my wife's hair for over a decade. And every time I tell people that, I'm like, bro, what? And I'm like, listen, it started as my wife needed. We moved from Baton Rouge to New York. When we moved from Baton Rouge to New York, my wife had lost her beautician. She had locks.
Okay.
She needed someone to maintain it. And so I told my wife, like, look, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to try. And sure as I tell you, man, I did it, bruh. And it became our intimate time.
I love it.
It became a time like I knew 2 to 3 hours out of maybe once a month, 2 to 3 hours of unadulterated, just our time. Me doing her hair, her sharing with me, you know, what her week was like, what her month was like, what she was worried about, what she was happy about, you know, thoughts she had on her mind, whatever. And at the same time, when I got to medical school, her, you know, need for me to do her hair turned into study sessions for me. So I would give her my medical school book and she would read it out to me for like an hour and a half to 2 hours while I was doing her hair. It was like a trade-off. So we spent half the time just chatting, catching up or whatever, and then spend the other half studying.
Man, your story needs to be a black love movie, man.
Hey,
seriously, hey,
you say that.
I can see that script.
You say that, but maybe that's happening already.
I would imagine so, man. But you know, some stuff you gotta keep going to your heart. So
yeah, it's some stuff that I'll probably only my wife and I know. But you know, I definitely think that it's stories like, you know, like ours that you rarely hear them, man. And when you do hear them, because like people always ask me, like, yo, how did you get through all this? And I'm like, yo, my wife used to tell me, and she still tells me, it never surprises me when you succeed. It only surprises me when you fail.
Wow.
So when you got somebody telling you that, and their actions are lining up with what they're telling you, you don't have another choice but to walk outside with an S on your chest.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you walk out the door like, listen, my wife told me I'm amazing. The rest of the world can tell me whatever they want, but my wife told me I'm amazing. I don't need to hear anything from y'all. Y'all can tell me whatever y'all want. It's not true. My wife told me I'm amazing. You feel me? So, and even to this day, man, my wife will pull me to the side from time to time, and she'll just say, honey, listen, you're amazing. I don't care what the world tells you, you're amazing. Bro, I'll walk outside. I'll walk outside sometimes with no shirt on. I'm like, my wife told me I'm amazing.
So last question I got for you, man. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to tell young brothers that either want to go down your path or want to have a career change?
Yeah, man. It's within your reach. I always tell on every podcast I go on, one, not for me, but for you. Follow my Instagram page, Dr. Russell Lede. It's just literally DR and then Russell Lede. And I guess you could like add it or whatever to the text for the podcast. But not necessarily for me as a person, but for some of the things that I've been able to capture in my lifetime of all the things that I've done. There was this video that I posted the first day I went to that hospital with a white coat on. I didn't know that video was going to go viral. I just did it because like that morning I had been crying so many tears of joy. I had been up since like 4 o'clock in the morning, bro. I was ironing my white coat. You know how like when you got a basketball game, how like your kicks are laced, you know what I'm saying? Your jersey, right? Everything is no extra strings hanging. You know, your tights are right. Everything is crisp. You know, your beard is right, everything, haircut on fleek, everything. You got the right moisturizer in the hair, it's everything. And I had done all that, and I put it on, bro, and I got in my car, and I was just like, this is my moment. I was like, I'm about to walk up in there, and they're going to be like Dr. Russell today. And I was like, it just all hit me in that moment. I was like, God, you brought me so far, like so far. From where I started, man, because it brought me back to those moments when I remember digging in the dumpster for dinner and my mom and my grandmother were in the car as a lookout behind Sam's Club. And here I am. I remember being on that ramp and so many doctors not giving me any play. And here I am going back into that hospital and you don't need to give me no play. One guy already put me on, and he's so proud of me that he literally called me and was like, yo, you did it, bud. He saw me in the hospital a few days ago, but he stopped everything he was doing and hugged me, man. He was so happy. He was so happy, bro. He was like, yo, y'all don't know who this is, but y'all need to know who that is. It's like, that dude right there. And he said it on Good Morning America, bro. He was like, medicine gonna be better for that dude right there being in medicine. He was like, medicine is lucky to have. And it's because I'm still connected, man. Like, I still got my hood cred. Because I ain't lose none of that. You know, like I said in the video, man, if you saw me in the grocery store, you wouldn't be thinking to yourself, like, man, that dude's a doctor. You'd be like, yo, that's just the homie. Like, he looked like he the homie. Like, my mom that's say, what, look like you fresh out of jail. But having that, man, and I tell the young folks, bro, like, you could keep all your flavor and your culture and your twang in your voice.
Yes.
You could keep all that and you could still be brilliant. You could be brilliant, like, beyond, bro, my name is at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And if you was to get a pick right now, it would not help this route. You feel me?
It's something about you didn't have to sell your soul. Nah. You didn't have to change your dialect. Nah, you didn't have to do anything. Nah. Change nothing about your blackness, nah, man. Sorry. Nah.
That's the best part about all this, Jay, is like the one thing that I'm more proud of than anything is that when all this is said and done, the hood ain't going to be able to call me a cornball.
You can sleep well about it.
A lot of people will be like, well, you know, that's not intellectualism. Yo, you can keep all that intellectualism. You can keep it. My heart is in the hood. My heart gonna stay in the hood, and it ain't leaving. It ain't leaving. I don't care what show you put me on. I don't care what, you know, whatever, what platform you want to put me on. Let me be me. You know, my wife used to always say, like, she'd be like, the one thing I could count on is, like, Russell gonna be Russell. And she always tell people at her job, she like, yo, y'all wouldn't believe my husband is who he is, because, like, he walk around here in basketball shorts and a t-shirt, and it's just, it's hard to believe. But I always tell her, I'm like, man, I gotta keep my culture. Because my people so count on me. My people count on me. Yo, I'm not knocking the cats who, you know, cornball it out.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do that for myself.
But I'm gonna tell you what, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, brother.
No, go ahead.
Why I think that's so important, especially coming from environments like we came from, that visual representation of a brother that is himself, but can still have success. The reason I'm such a proponent of black marriage and black love, when young kids see that, they can aspire for it.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't see enough of it. When I was growing up, the Jeffersons, Good Times, you know what I'm saying? And then you got the Cosby Show, and you're like, okay, now we're elevating. You know, and it changed our mind. It was the first time we saw something like that. So when you see it in person, it's really going to make your brain go.
Yeah, man, it's important, bro. It's the most important thing. And I see people in the hospital who get caught off guard. And they like trying to frame it. They're like, it's like it doesn't compute sometimes. But I always tell them, like, listen, this ain't for you. Like, this for that kid who's going to come in here with his mom. And he gonna see me and be like, yo, I could be him.
Nope.
Cause I can still walk up to him and give him that. I can still walk up to him and give him that. I know who Lil Baby is. I know who the baby is. I know who Megan Thee Stallion is, Lizzo. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not, I know who, you know what I'm saying? NBA Youngboy is. I know who that is. Like, I'm not out of it, you know, and I can still talk to you about J. Cole and K. Dot. Like, you know, we can talk about whatever. We can talk about Kendrick Lamar. We can talk about, you know, Gregory Porter, we can talk about Nat King Cole, you know, Frank Sinatra. I got the whole gambit. So it's just like, you know, we can talk about West African music, East African music, North African music, South African music. We can talk about it all, you know. So, and that's the luxury of all these experiences that I've had. And if I had to give a message to some young kid listening to this, it's like, man, don't ever be afraid to explore the world. You'll learn more about where you came from by exploring the world. A lot of times, the environment we came from is the extent of where we came from. It's not some of your culture came from parts of Africa you ain't never been to before.
Mm-hmm.
Gumbo, black eyed peas, cabbage, all these different things, etouffee, all these other things. Man, they got some connections.
Yeah, it's dope. Wow, brother. Thank you, man, for coming on this show. I want to pause, and I want you to go ahead and pub your social media handle. So I know you mentioned it before, and I'm going to put it on the website. But just go ahead and the White Coats as well as your IG.
Yeah, so the 15 White Coats can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the 15 White Coats. And my personal Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is Dr. Dr. Russell, RUSSELL. LEDET. You can find me on any of those platforms. Even if you want to just Google me, you'll be able to find my email address and shoot your boy an email. We can chat.
Love it, brother, man. Like I said, I reached out to this guy and he instantly responded back. And so I was excited about it, man. Gave us some good nuggets, man. I really appreciate it, brother.
Yeah, nah, man. Appreciate you having me on, bro.
I hope these authentic stories show different paths to success and provide mentorship. Please be sure to visit us at drjinterviews.com for additional content and social media info. Stay resilient.